91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today we visit with George Mason University professor and social anthropologist Janine Waddell. She's the author of a new book, Unaccountable: How Elite Power Brokers Corrupt Our Finances, Freedoms, and Security. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. She describes potential shadow elites and lobbyists who violate the public trust. Among Waddell's points of interest are supposedly objective think tanks, which lend credence to opponents of global warming or the pharmaceutical industry. She explains the often used term dark money, which sponsors numerous unidentified groups and TV ads to help shape opinion. Many of the corruptions occur in the medical field. Stay tuned. Topical Currents up next after the news.
And we return. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. This hour we speak with George Mason University's social anthropology professor, Janine Waddell. She's studied and written about 21st century style corruption, which is often subtle and unnoticed.
Professor Waddell's latest book is Unaccountable: How Elite Power Brokers Corrupt Our Finances, Freedoms, and Security. And she joins us from NPR in Washington. Welcome, Professor Waddell.
Thank you. Pleased to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. So I'd like to establish you're speaking about corruption, but not the obvious kind that we usually hear of, where laws are clearly broken. Explain what you mean, this new kind of corruption. What are you describing?
Well, this is when somebody who purports to be operating in our interest is actually operating in his or her own interest. So this is a fundamental violation of our trust. So for example, when we go to a physician, we expect that physician is prescribing the treatment or medication that's actually going to serve our health and our well-being. But that physician may have been influenced even unknowingly by, say, what is called a key opinion leader, high-status physicians or medical researchers who are paid or perked by pharmaceutical companies to convince their fellow professionals that a company's product is the best, and their sponsorship is undisclosed. So we go to the physician thinking that that person is acting in our interest. They may even think so, but they don't know that they're being influenced by this undisclosed sponsorship. So that's a violation of our trust, and this goes beyond the typical quid pro quo and the proverbial cash in the cash under the table kind of arrangement. So it's much more difficult to track and to see. It's less visible, but it is potentially much more damaging to the public good.
Is this sort of more subtle corruption really new, or is it just that it's more frequent these days?
Well, it's much more frequent, and there are new forms of it that would not have been possible in the before the digital age, mm-hmm. before the era of the internet, which gives us so much more information, of course, but at the same time has ironically made information, getting information, more difficult in many ways, and what we've seen is a streamlining of mainstream media messaging the kind that we even saw, and this is might be shocking to some of the listeners, but that we even saw under late communism. I started my career working in and studying and writing about communist societies in the late 1980s, and what we're seeing today in some of the TV in television is we're seeing this kind of repeated messaging. Jon Stewart likes to show it by going from station to station to station, where the people repeat the same kinds of even the, using the same words very often. And we're seeing this in the United States today, despite the digital age. So is it new? It's not entirely new, but but the digital age has created a very different dynamic and made it more easier to track on the one hand, and at the same time, much more difficult.
Would an example of that kind of behavior be the a couple of years ago the death panel term that everyone was spouting? Be they newscasters and pundits and also government sources.
Absolutely. So the same language gets repeated ad infinitum. It gets adapted, and the media, of course, the mainstream media pick it up and go with it, and it's very, very difficult to counter. The only real counter is parody. People turn to parody like they turn to Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert's former program for truth, more than they and they find truth there more than they might in a regular television broadcast. So, and this is a striking and very disturbing parallel with late communism.
Let's talk more about that. First of all, what was your position there? You were in Poland, was it?
Yes, I spent a number of years in Poland in the 1980s as a Fulbright scholar. I was trying to understand the difference between how the system actually worked, how the system worked in practice as opposed to how it was supposed to work, and how the you know, communist economy and politics were actually supposed to work was very different from how people actually lived. There was a shortage economy. People couldn't get the goods and services that they needed, much like in, you were talking earlier about Cuba, much like in Cuba today, there's a thriving informal economy. And the way people survive under those circumstances and get what they want or get what they need to have a somewhat better life is through their informal networks and under the table dealing. Polish sociologists called it dirty togetherness. And no doubt there's a very similar dynamic operating in Cuba today. And what I see and what I find disturbing today in the United States is that there is a growing gap between how people actually operate and how the system purports to work. And people are beginning to recognize this, and they're beginning to call this corruption. Think about the Occupy Wall Street movements and the Tea Party movement. Now, you would think, it seems like, because they come from such very different ideological positions, that they have nothing in common. But in fact, they share this idea that there's something wrong. There's something amiss, and we can't quite put our finger on it, but things don't work quite the way they're supposed to work. And this what people are sensing is that there's a small group of insiders and then more and more outsiders who can't get in. And we see this insiderism when we think about how Wall Street has worked and the bailout and some of the financial deals that have gone on. It's the Goldman Sachs Abacus deal a number of years ago when Goldman Sachs bet some of its clients unknowingly, including pension funds, against others, and so those others were winning, and that one can argue is a violation of their trust. It's a violation of the public trust, and today we see this violation in just about every arena. We talked very briefly about the healthcare arena and the key opinion leaders who are paid by pharmaceutical or medical device companies and who are high-status physicians affiliated with medical schools and journals and so on. And they are at the same time gatekeeping for these pharmaceutical companies and advocating drugs and treatments. And as we said, the public don't often know what's going on, and so we are being duped by this system.
Well, you also made a point of saying that the doctors often don't know that they're being duped by the system.
Exactly. And so this happens in so many different arenas. I have looked at the activities of top academic economists who promote specific financial reform proposals. And advise government bodies in the media. And in fact, there was a study done by the University of Massachusetts in Amherst that looked at nearly 20 top academic economists who were promoting these financial reform proposals and advising congressional committees and so on in the run-up to and just after the 2008 financial crisis. And they found that most of the time, these economists did not identify their links to private financial institutions, their other affiliations that would compromise their objectivity and their neutrality. So the Congress people, the public, is listening to them, thinking that they are giving objective information as economists and not knowing that they might have a dog in the fight promoting this industry or company or that. So that is a key issue for our time.
We're going to stop, just put a period there, Professor Waddell. We need to take a short break on today's Topical Currents. We're speaking with Professor Janine Waddell, social anthropologist, professor at George Mason University, about her book, Unaccountable. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we resume our conversation with Professor Janine Waddell. We're talking about her book, Unaccountable, How Elite Power Brokers Corrupt Our Finances, Freedoms, and Security. If you'd like to join in, easy enough, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Or Bonnie will take your email, radio@WLRN.com. By the way, Bonnie, Happy New Year.
I was going to say.
We didn't exchange our New Year's greetings
and our listeners.
It's also the 16th year of Topical Currents starting this month.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Okay. Well, you too.
Well, thanks. Okay, so Professor Waddell, I think our listeners will be able to relate to this story a little bit, or some of them. You speak of these siloized bureaucrats through the story of this mix-up with the Bank of America and your credit card, your credit rating, and then resulting problems refinancing your home. So if you could tell us about this huge discrepancy you had with Bank of America and how that affected your credit rating, I think we'll be able to relate
right.
to that.
Okay, so what happened was that I went to refinance my home, and I found out that I had a bad credit rating, and I couldn't, I was bewildered because I'd always had good credit. And the person who was in charge of that I had hired to work on this thought that I would never get the problem fixed. He said it will never you'll never be able to work it out. So what had actually happened was that the bank had ruined my credit because they said I had a bill for $13 and I think it was 26 cents for that was unpaid, and it was on a credit card that I had actually canceled. And not only had I canceled that credit card and was told that I had a zero balance, I actually was given a cancellation number by Bank of America and the name of the person. I took the name of the person that I spoke with. So I had those records. I had the day I spoke. I had it. I keep records like that. And so, but nonetheless, my mortgage broker said, you'll never be able to sort this out with them. So I took this as a challenge. And I wrote down every phone conversation I had, and I had well over 20 with people in located in various places in Bank of America. Judy in Colorado, Juan in Puerto Rico, Carol in Ohio. I'm sure you've all had, we all have stories like this. It took me over 20 conversations and, many, many hours to sort this all out. And finally I did, because I was, very, very, very persistent. And finally I got somebody on the line and I said, this reminds me of living under communism, except under communism, you could always find somebody to bribe. And I said, I'd be willing to send you $1,000 to which the woman, of course, laughed. But I think and I was joking. But I think the fact that I was comparing it to, the big, bad bureaucracy of communism made her stand up and appreciate that. And I did finally, after, much, much, much persistence, get it sorted out. But the reason that I talk about it in the book, and I call this structured unaccountability, because what happens is that everybody, Carol in Ohio, Juan in Puerto Rico, Judy in Arkansas, they're all operating in their own little silos, and they're not bad people, but the problem is that their job is not actually to solve a difficult problem. Their job is to fulfill the checklist. How are you today? What can I help you with? And their knowledge is really very limited. And so the problem is you don't really know who to go to and how to solve the problem. It's become so amorphous that it's created a whole society of outsiders. Again, we talked earlier about Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party movements. To whom do you target this frustration? It's very difficult. I mean, under communism, at least, you could find somebody to bribe. You could locate a person. You could find who was responsible for the most part. Whereas in our system, it's very difficult to do that. And this is true not just when we're solving our own problems in trying to seek restitution, but this term structured unaccountability was actually invented by people who were studying the banking system and the mortgage crisis. And we're looking at how bankers were siloized into their own little units. And so my job as a banker was simply to take this package of financial products without knowing what's in it, to sell it to the next guy who also didn't know what was in it, to collect my bonus. And my obligation again is to this checklist and to the bonus. It's certainly not to the person who is buying the home, let alone to the larger public. So our whole system of accountability that looks just at the, that considers just this kind of checklist type of approach. Let's check off the tick boxes and may I help you with anything else today, is very flawed. It actually can lead to creating unaccountability rather than solving the problems of accountability.
Janine Waddell, you spend a lot of time in the book talking about the numerous disgraced officials who wind up on boards and as important advisors of various organizations. Jumping to mind quickly would be General David Petraeus, seemingly so staid and honorable and had a lot of things going on.
Right. Well, I write about retired generals and admirals who sit on government advisory boards that afford them information, privileged information, and at the same time that they have access to that privileged information, they are paid to advise military agencies or to be consultants to defense and intelligence contractors, or even to set up their own venture capital companies. So the point is they can use the information, they can parlay the information they get from continuing to have their security clearances and serving on government advisory boards and so on into these other venues for which they're getting paid. And again, we, the public, have an information problem. We can't know how that information is getting used. And this is a systemic problem. An investigation by the Boston Globe that amassed a database of some 750 retired generals and admirals, and to which my Shadow Influence Project has added many more data points, found that just over the last several decades, these retired generals and admirals went from actual retirement, that is, they stopped working when they retired from military service, to mostly continuing to work somehow for the defense industry. So, in other words, 20 years ago, when retired generals and admirals, when generals and admirals retired, they played golf or they played with their grandkids or whatever. Today, they predominantly continue to work in the defense industry. So, as I said, it's an information problem. They can do so in a way that makes it very difficult for us to know what motivates their decision making, let alone whether they're pushing products and projects that are in the public interest and that might even compromise national interest. So, yeah.
I was just going to say, you wrote a piece for the Huffington Post about the five places former politicians, both Democrats and Republicans, go after leaving Congress. But what is the problem with former politicians capitalizing on their knowledge?
Well, certainly there's no problem per se, and we all want to capitalize on our knowledge, and we all want to continue to be relevant. But again, we're subjecting ourselves to a big information problem. What I found is that we no longer have just a revolving door phenomenon. The revolving door, of course, still exists, but instead of shuttling players from, say, lawmaking to classic lobbying, the door now has a lot of exit and entry points. So if you can visualize this revolving door with multiple exit and entry points, and there are about five places that both Democratic and Republicans leaving Congress and their top staff people often go when their terms in office are over. And one is to think tanks, and I should point out that think tanks, many are no longer, we think of them as these staid, bastions of wonkiness that produce these long-term studies. But today, many operate more like partisan fighters, and they write these quickly assembled reports, and they have legions of journalists, which they can get the very top-notch journalists because of the gutting, the recent gutting of media in the past decade plus, and the many very, very qualified, talented, unemployed journalists. So that's one place they go, think tanks. Another is public relations firms. So, for instance, both Senators Kent Conrad and Jug Gregg, who are both past chairmen of the Senate Budget Committee, when they left office, they joined the world's biggest PR firm as so-called strategic advisors, and providing counsel to government, corporate, nonprofit clients. So that working the government angle as unregistered lobbyists is a big place they go. And I should point out this point about unregistered, or what I call shadow lobbyists. Mm-hmm. The number of registered lobbyists has actually declined by nearly 25% since 2007, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. And that is because I argue that the new way to operate in Washington is to be, and not only in Washington, is to be an unregistered or a shadow lobbyist. That is to wield the same influence, to use the contacts and so on, but to not actually registered as a lobbyist. And the business of influencing has changed so much that, in fact, the Association of Lobbyists, which used to be called the American League of Lobbyists, decided to change its name to the Association of Government Relations Professionals. So PR firms is in addition to think tanks, is another place these former congressmen, senator, and their staffs and cabinet officials, former cabinet officials go. A third place is to the media. This is very important. Many of them serve as media advisors. And again, because of the gutting of the media, in particular investigative reporting, it is so much cheaper to put what I call shadow lobbyists on the air, because that way you don't have to pay reporters to go out and actually investigate a story. Instead, you can have the retired general or the retired admiral, or you can have former Senator Tom Daschle or former Homeland Security Chief Mike Chertoff on the air, talking about various issues. The problem is that the very issues that they're often called upon to address are those issues for which they have a dog in the fight. For instance, former Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff was on the air incessantly after the attempted Christmas Day airliner bombing several years ago. Mm-hmm. And it only came out later that that he was advocating, he was on the air advocating these full body scanners as a cure-all for airport security. And only later did we learn that at the time his company had the only license to manufacture these scanners. Again, it's an information problem. It's an information problem. How do we, the public, know what agendas these people have? And that is a violation of our trust, and that is corruption.
A short break on today's Topical Currents. Professor Janine Waddell, she's written Unaccountable. We'll be right back. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we'll resume our conversation with Professor Janine Waddell, social anthropologist and professor at George Mason University, also an award-winning author. She wrote The Shadow Elite. Prior to this, this book we're discussing is Unaccountable, How Elite Power Brokers Corrupt Our Finances, Freedom, and Security. If you'd like to join in the conversation, talk about structured unaccountability that Professor Waddell is talking about, if you have an opinion or a question, the number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576.
Professor Janine Waddell, could you touch a little bit, as you do in your book, on the fake grassroots groups that are funded by the powerful, actually, and claiming to be of the people?
Yes, indeed. Yes. So one of the problems with where we are today is that we, the public, have much less faith in our public institutions than we used to. And this is shown out, this is borne out in public opinion polls the world over, not only in the United States, and it's true whether we're talking about Congress or mainstream churches or the media or many formal institutions. And so what's happened is that we turn to our friends in our networks to find that trust, to find to be able to have some trust in information and in our to be able to organize our lives. And so what's happened is that people with who have agendas take advantage of have been taking advantage of our trust and the faith that we have been placing in organizations that appear to be grassroots, that is, they appear to be made up of people like you and I, but in fact, they're being funded by, say, billionaires with an agenda or industries with agendas, wanting to promote their products or their protocols. So I have documented this in a number of different arenas, in health, in energy, and in the food supply. With regard to healthcare, for nearly every disease, there's a patient advocacy group, and these advocacy groups do attract real sufferers and of course, sincere advocates. But in recent years, big pharmaceutical companies have been exploiting their vulnerabilities to conduct PR campaigns that are veiled. So companies can push their preferred drugs on prospective patients and their doctors, and then these advocacy groups serve as conduits of money and influence in advocating for say legislation that's favored by drug makers. And all of this then appears to be, and it's under the cover of grassroots advocacy, but it isn't really.
Do you have a specific example about this with the patients of a certain, you know, that suffer from a certain illness?
Well, I think I give some examples in the book, and I think that the issue is that we see it across the board in these different we see it in the different venues, and anyone who's involved in an advocacy group, whether it's leukemia or some form of cancer, mm-hmm. or rheumatoid arthritis or Alzheimer's disease, should be very interested in understanding who is funding this group. And if it's not on the website of the organization, that's a very bad sign. And even if it is on the website of an organization, you still should try to find out more about it. Try to find out more about what is their agenda. And how does the funding come? Very often, because the story that I tell is substantially about the laundering of influence. So there's influence, but there's an information problem for the public. We, the public, don't know who is wielding that influence. And there's dark money. Dark money is not just something that we need to pay attention to when there's an election cycle and a blizzard of TV ads, but it's something that we need to now pay attention to every day with regard to these so-called grassroots organizations. I've also charted them write about them with regard to energy. There's something called the Clean and Safe Energy Coalition, which is described on its website as a national grassroots organization that supports the increased use of nuclear energy. But what we don't know, and you'd be forgiven if you missed some of the crucial words on the website, which says that it's funded by the industry, and the industry has had a very powerful bullhorn for in the form of the former Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Christine Todd Whitman, who has appeared at grassroots style venues all over the country, and written in top newspapers advocating clean nuclear energy. Mm-hmm. And yet these pieces very seldom make clear that that the money comes from the industry. So again, we the public think that these are neutral, professional, impartial judgments when they're not.
So she's being paid by the nuclear industry?
Well, she's affiliated with this Clean and Safe Energy coalition. And they are funded by the industry.
We need to take one more short break on today's Topical Currents, speaking with Professor Janine Waddell. When we come back, we're going to talk about solutions. Stay with us. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Professor Janine Waddell from George Mason University. Her latest book is Unaccountable: How Elite Power Brokers Corrupt Our Finances, Freedom, and Security. So, Professor Waddell, this is pretty grim situation that you're painting for us. Do you see any hope of systemic remedies short of singing the national anthem in order to get the attention of TSA agents? And you can start by telling us its story, because it's a great story. But then I do want to talk about remedies.
Great, yeah. So, I don't go through the full body scanners for a number of reasons. I go through the metal detectors, but not the full body scanners. And so that means that every time I fly, which is fairly frequently, I opt for the full body pat down. And of course, it takes a while for TSA to find a female assist who can do that. And there was one occasion when I was was worried that I was going to miss my flight. I was very politely asking every 5 minutes, is that female assist coming? Will she be here soon? Because I don't want to miss my flight. And finally, in exasperation, after waiting for a very long time, I said, okay, I've got to do something that's going to draw attention, but that won't get me arrested. So I burst out in full voice singing the Star Spangled Banner. No, say, can you see by the dawn's early light?
Nice voice, true.
Thank you. In full voice, and it took a while for the people to find out to see where the music was coming from, and everybody was quite puzzled. But how long do you think it took them to find me that female assist? I ask.
How long? Quickly.
Very quickly. Very, very, very quickly. And, you know, because I thought, you know, I thought, well, it would be awkward. A media headline that says, woman arrested for singing national anthem, I thought, you know, would be a little unlikely. So the reason I write about this in the book is because it's one of those unconventional remedies. It's a form of parody. And we started off the show talking about how attractive parody has become to us, given the climate that we face. And the point is that if I had screamed and yelled and made a big fuss, of course, TSA would have had a remedy for that. They know how to deal with that. But how are they going to deal with somebody smiling and singing in full voice the Star Spangled Banner? And, you know, I used to do some singing, so I wasn't completely unprepared for that. But parody does, with a sense of humor, parody does work. But more systemic, it's not a systemic solution, but more systemically, I think there definitely are things that we, the public, can and must do.
Such as?
So one of the things we talked about earlier was the growing number of outsiders versus the small number of insiders who have information and can use that to their advantage, whether it's the economists testifying before congressional committees or whether it's the retired generals and admirals who are using the information that they have to make money in defense industries, or whether it's the high-status key opinion leader physicians. So what people who are insiders need to do is to begin to bring in outsiders. And this has actually been structured into a couple of settings in finance. In Federal Reserve, there was a recent case of this. So bringing in outsiders, if we are insiders, and asking them to do the smell test, what would the postman or the school teacher say about this behavior? How would they respond to it? What are ways of changing this activity if it needs to be changed? So systematically bringing in outsiders and creating contacts among communities that are becoming more and more isolated and splintered as inequalities have grown so substantially in our society. So this outsiders versus insider equation absolutely needs to be worked at and really blasted away at. So that's one big area. What can we as individual citizens do? Well, we need to follow the players, not just the money, and connect the dots. So if we see somebody on TV, on CNN, who's touting a particular point of view or a product while purporting to be an impartial expert, we can Google them, and we can keep Googling them. I call it one click more, to try to find out what agenda might that individual have. We can insist that when people are on the news, that all of their agendas or the most important ones are disclosed, not that they're not just identified as former cabinet official, former senator, because very often those people have more current agendas, and that's why they're on the media, more current undisclosed agendas. So one click more. Third, we need to understand, we need to be much more pay much more attention with regard to regulation. Regulation, passing a law, the promise of regulation doesn't end with the president's signature. If you think about the Dodd-Frank laws that were designed to prevent further financial crises, what's happened is that the lobbyists and probably shadow lobbyists have eaten away at some of the guts of that legislation, and that should not be able to happen. The spotlight has moved away from it once it was signed by the president, and allowing the legislation to be eaten away at. So that's one problem. Another issue with regard to legislation is that we need to much more carefully anticipate the consequences of the laws that are passed. There was a law passed in 2007 to curb lobbying, and that is one of the reasons that the number of unregulated lobbyists, I would surmise, has gone up so substantially, and the number of registered lobbyists has gone down by nearly 25% since 2007. So we need to be much more careful about the regulation that we are passing. We have to anticipate the consequences. We have to understand that what does get passed doesn't end with the president's signature, and there's also something called enforcement. So it's not just about the passage of the law.
We have only, I'm sorry, Professor, we have only a minute or two left. I'd like you to touch on the post-prime minister tenure of Tony Blair.
Okay. Well, the reason that I'm chuckling is because he has been extremely active, there's nothing wrong with that. We all want to stay relevant. We all want to be in the game. But he has created what has been dubbed Blair Inc., and which the British Daily Telegraph has described as a confusing mix of business, politics, and philanthropy that's administered by a very complex system of companies. So he has advised Wall Street banks, European insurers, the government of Kazakhstan, among others, and even the late Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. While he was counseling Gaddafi, apparently on deals that the investment firm J.P. Morgan wanted, he also served at the same time as an advisor to J.P. Morgan and, additionally, as an official peace envoy to the Middle East. So here, there's an information problem which is essentially unsolvable for the public. What role was he playing when? Whose agenda did he have in mind at what time? So it's very difficult when somebody plays these overlapping roles, some of them official, some of them supposedly in the public interest, like being an official peace envoy to the Middle East, and mm-hmm. others that are obviously to make money. It's very difficult for us, the public, to sort this out. And this creates a kind of corruption that we need to counter.
Well, we want to thank you very much, Professor Janine Waddell, social anthropologist and professor at George Mason University. Her latest book is Unaccountable: How Elite Power Brokers Corrupt Our Finances, Freedom, and Security. We want to thank you so much for spending your time with us today.
You're most welcome. My pleasure.
How about singing the anthem at a Dolphins game?
Now, how does it go? I'll sing after you. How's that?
Okay.
No.
Thanks
and
so much.
And that wraps up today's program. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical supervision by online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio downloads of this and previous programs at our website, that's wlrn.org. Also, check out the Topical Currents Facebook page for important links discussion, photos, and more. Tomorrow's program looks at the labor scene in the 21st century. Unions are long past their influence peak of the 1950s and 60s. Could they see a rebirth through grassroots efforts? We'll speak with longtime union organizer and activist Steve Early, who's written Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. Joker, Joseph Cooper, Joker Cooper. For Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening.
Happy New Year.
Here and Now next.